From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a grim discovery in the West Bank, the latest on the Iraqi crisis, Nigerian government condemning Sunday's violence, plus the World Cup action in Brazil. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The hunt for three missing Israeli youths in the West Bank has come to a tragic end. Robert Berger reporting now from the VOA Jerusalem Bureau.
After a long and massive search, Israeli forces found the bodies of three Jewish seminary students who were kidnapped in the West Bank more than 2 weeks ago. The teenagers apparently were shot shortly after they were abducted while hitchhiking near the biblical town of Hebron. The kidnapping prompted the biggest Israeli military crackdown in the West Bank in a decade. More than 400 Palestinians have been arrested, mostly members of the Islamic militant group Hamas. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu blamed Hamas for the murders and said the group will pay a heavy price. General Nitzan Alon, the commander of Israeli forces in the West Bank, said the search for the two Hamas members believed to have carried out the kidnapping is continuing. He said thousands of troops are involved in the search. The war on terror did not begin today and it won't end tomorrow, the general said, adding that Israel will settle scores with Hamas. But while Hamas has praised the kidnapping, it has not gone any further than that. Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri made this statement in the Gaza Strip. He said no Palestinian faction has claimed responsibility for the attack, including Hamas. Abu Zuhri also brushed off Israeli threats of retaliation, saying that if Israel wages war on Gaza, it will open up the gates of hell. In Washington, President Barack Obama issued a statement condemning what he called this senseless act of terror against innocent youth. He said the U.S. has offered its full support to Israel and the Palestinian Authority to find those who committed the crime and bring them to justice. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And for some insight into how Israel might respond to the killing of those three Israeli teenagers, VOA's Michael Lippin spoke with Omri Sarin, a senior strategist at the Israel Project, a Washington-based organization that provides information to journalists covering Israeli issues.
There's a range of options that analysts say publicly they could undertake. This is everything from imposing closures to a systematic campaign to root out Hamas in the West Bank, all the way to retaliation in the Gaza Strip. You know, something very, very dangerous has been happening in recent days in the Gaza Strip. What we've seen is, for the first time in a year and a half, since November 2012, Hamas has begun openly firing rockets into Israel out of the Gaza Strip. This hasn't happened since the last Israeli operation in the Gaza Strip. And over the weekend, literally hours before the bodies of the three boys were discovered, Hamas launched around 16 rockets into Israel, something that would be, independent of everything else, a massive escalation in the region. And so I think that when we're talking about Israeli responses, we have to look not just at what might be called retaliation for what happened to the three Israeli teenagers, but a concentrated effort to reestablish stability and deterrence in the region, which will begin, in large part, with measures to punish those who are responsible for the kidnapping.
How do you think that Hamas and other militant groups will respond to what looks like imminent Israeli retaliation for these killings? And bearing in mind that the Israeli defense minister, Moshe Ya'alon, I believe said as recently as the last day or two that he doesn't think Hamas wants an escalation of the situation, given that its finances are in a bad state and that it's been relatively isolated in the region recently?
So, you know, this is actually an interesting question. There's been a vociferous debate both on the Israeli side and within the Washington, D.C. foreign policy community about what Hamas's motives are. It was easier to make the case that Minister Yalon was making before Hamas fired rockets at Israel over the weekend. So, you know, there were signs that they did want an escalation and signs that they didn't want an escalation. But certainly, unfortunately, what seemed to happen over the weekend gave additional weight to those who believe that they did, that they do seek an escalation, unfortunately. Now, there's no doubt that Hamas would prefer to be able to get away with kidnapping and murdering Israelis and firing rockets at Israeli civilians and face no retaliation. So in a sense, it's always true that Hamas, quote unquote, doesn't want escalation. Of course they don't. They want to be able to continue getting away with crimes and terrorism and atrocities without facing a retaliation, which is what people are calling an escalation. But, you know, their actions belie that, and at some point the Israelis are going to decide that the violence and the terrorism has reached an intolerable level, and I think that they're going to decide that in the coming days, in fact.
That was Omri Sarin of the Israel Project speaking with VOA's Michael Lippin. As Iraqi government forces battle Sunni militants north of Baghdad, the jihadi militant group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant has formally proclaimed the establishment of a caliphate or Islamic State in the territories it controls in Iraq and Syria. We get more now from Edward Uranian in the VOA Middle East Bureau.
فقررت الدولة الإسلامية ممثلة بأهل الحل والعقد فيها.
It was a symbolic declaration and one that many supporters of an Islamic world order have long awaited. The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant spokesman spiced his declaration with verses from the Quran and insisted the caliphate would be for the glory of the Islamic nation. Abu Muhammad al-Adnani insisted the historic borders of the region, including those of Syria and Iraq, have now fallen, and proclaimed the group's leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, to be caliph of the self-proclaimed state. He warned Muslims of the region to support him. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Growing number of Kurdish families in Turkey are calling for more for the return of their children, who they say have been abducted by the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. PKK denies the claim, but with Turkish Prime Minister stepping in, the dispute is putting pressure on an already stalled peace process. Dorian Jones reports from Diyarbakir, the main city in Turkey's predominantly Kurdish southeast.
Artık ben dayanamıyorum. Ben artık kokusunu gömleğinden almak istemiyorum. Ben vedatımı kokusunu.
In the sweltering summer heat, a group of families hold a daily vigil for their children, who they say were kidnapped by the PKK in recent months. Each carries a photograph of their child. Some were as young as 14 when they disappeared. Suriye Tokla, whose son disappeared 3 months ago, says she's convinced her son was kidnapped by the rebel group. My son couldn't have gone on his own will, she says. He didn't have such love for them. I'm sure he was tricked and didn't go on his own will. The families claim the rebels are holding their children in mountain bases just across the Turkish border in Iraqi Kurdistan. Throughout the three decades of conflict, thousands of young Kurdish men and women have gone to the mountains, a euphemism for joining the PKK. Until now, there have been few voices claiming any were kidnapped. But Turkey's Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has stepped in and taken up the family's cause. The dispute comes at a delicate time in the government-initiated peace process with the rebel group. According to Fatma Öncü, a member of the ruling AK Party's National Committee from Diyarbakir, the peace process has allowed people to start speaking out against the PKK. She says women are now coming out to the streets and voicing that their children are being kept in this way. As a party, we're supporting these women in this process in every way, she said. But many pro-Kurdish political groups backed the PKK in dismissing claims of abduction. They say all those who join the PKK are volunteers and accuse the government of generating the controversy as a distraction over the lack of progress in the peace process. Edip Yashar of the Democratic Society Congress, a pro-Kurdish movement, says the claims of abduction are groundless.
Söyleme kim inanır? Aslında hani kargalar güler misali, hükümet söylediğine kendisi de inanmıyor.
Who would believe in such claims of abduction, he says, adding, even the crows will laugh at these statements by the government. Yashar says the PKK has stated no one under 16 will be given positions in its armed structure, and that the group says it will send back children who want to go home. Back at the family's vigil, the PKK pledge has been met with both scepticism and guarded optimism, according to Surya Tokla. She says the mothers are determined and won't be going anywhere until their children come back. My son is 14 years old. God willing, he'll be sent back, she says. We are waiting. Let's see. No date has been given by the PKK to return any of the children. Observers say the families could well be pawned in a wider struggle between the government and the pro-Kurdish movement over the stalled peace process. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Diyarbakir.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Nigerian government condemning the weekend violence in the northern part of the country. Suspected Islamist militants killed more than 50 people Sunday in attacks on churches. Michael Mary is a spokesman for the Nigerian government.
Government acknowledges the attack in Kautik Heri, Kwada, and Brijuzu local communities about 10 kilometers from Chibok in Borno State. From reports so far, we understand that there are casualties, including amongst the attackers who were shot by the military while attempting to flee the area. At present, government is working closely with local sources and community leaders to ascertain the extent of damage and accurate figures as a result thereof.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said Monday horrific attacks by Boko Haram are becoming an almost daily occurrence in northeastern Nigeria. In a statement Monday, he condemned the continuing violence and conveyed his solidarity and sympathy to the people of Nigeria. And at the U.S. State Department, spokesperson Jennifer Psaki told reporters that the U.S. sends its sympathy to the families of those killed in the weekend violence and remains committed to helping find the 200-plus schoolgirls who were kidnapped earlier this year by Boko Haram.
We have a team that's been on the ground for several weeks now. We'll continue to evaluate additional resources, what additional resources we can provide. I wish I did have an update on it, but unfortunately there's not one at this point to provide.
Terrorists from the Boko Haram group have killed thousands of people during their five-year insurgency to establish an Islamic State in Nigeria's northeast, with attacks on schools, churches, mosques, bus stations, and other public places. Italian Navy has found the bodies of 30 migrants in the hold of a smuggler's boat. They were thought to have suffocated or drowned during the crossing from North Africa. The vessel was carrying about 600 migrants in all. Italy's Navy has rescued more than 5,000 would-be immigrants in the last 2 days. The migrants, most believed to be from Africa and the Middle East, were found on an overloaded fishing boat between Libya and Sicily. Italian officials say more than 50,000 migrants have reached Italy from North Africa so far this year. They're asking the European Union to do more to help manage the influx of refugees from the economic and political turmoil in the area. A recently released report on agriculture in Africa points to entrepreneurship as the key to improving and sustaining food production on the continent. The report, titled Small and Growing Entrepreneurship in Africa Culture, was released in London by the Montpelier Panel, a group of agriculture and trade experts from Europe and Africa who are working together to improve food sustainability in sub-Saharan Africa. The report calls for increased investment for entrepreneurship in the rural food sector and cites agriculture as the key sector for creating jobs for African young people. Daniel Gadd is an entrepreneur who heads Omega Farms just outside of Addis Ababa. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the significance of the new report.
Africa produces over $280 billion worth of agriculture products, and most of that production is not in the value chain, and it does not involve youth employment, does not involve entrepreneurs. Most of it is raw grain and raw cereals that are produced by a very poorly paid farmers.
As an entrepreneur yourself with running the Omega Farms business just outside of Addis Ababa, what would you say are some of your biggest challenges right now?
One of the biggest challenges, retaining youth employment, keeping the young men and women who are from the rural countryside to stay and work there, to grow and develop and become entrepreneur and business people. The young women are attracted by jobs into the urban communities, young men as well. The development of the urban centers is forcing a lot of migration into the cities because the wages are higher, more rewarding, and more interesting work. Agriculture is perceived as a bit old-fashioned, not rewarding, not dynamic, does not have a lot of things to do with the internet or any of the new technologies. I would like to see more entrepreneurial opportunities for young women and men in the rural countryside. And as you see in the report, the Montpelier report refers to the need for development of training and education programs and entrepreneurial skills, and maybe some form of incubation system to teach young women and men how to become businessmen, how to develop new products, new services, and get more into the value chain in the rural countryside.
Another one of the perceptions regarding agriculture that young people may see is in the technology of it. I mean, when they're looking at maybe a big old tractor that is not doing the work that it should do. So one thing is needed is technology. So how do you get the funding and the programs that are going to give the necessary technology that is needed to keep up with agriculture?
Kim, you're absolutely right that you hit it on the head. This is the challenge. The challenge is to create the opportunity for young women and men to be able to take advantage of mobile technology. We have examples in Nigeria and as well as in Kenya and many parts of Africa and in Ethiopia. We also have some internet-based services that are directly related to new and emerging opportunities and jobs for young men and women in the rural countryside. The challenge for those of us in agriculture in Africa that the Montpelier panel report has pointed out to is to find a way to get financing that is patient capital, that is in quantities that are small enough for young entrepreneurs to be able to take advantage of and manage their cash flow and their working capital to be able to develop all these new services. And there is money out there, but we're trying to find a way how to make it work for the young women and men who are trying to become entrepreneurs in the new agriculture in Africa.
Do you think the international community is focusing enough on agricultural projects and putting the funding there so that more jobs and more technology can be created to bring young people into the sector?
Well, they are. You have programs like Feed the Future, which is committed at very high levels by President Obama. The United Kingdom has committed to the nutrition side in significant numbers. So there are billions involved here. But we are producing food. We're going to increase production of food. But we need young women and men to be able to process food, package food, label food, develop new products and services that are nutritious for the emerging economies in Africa.
That was Daniel Gadd, Managing Director of Omega Farms. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko says he will not renew a 10-day unilateral ceasefire in eastern Ukraine, and vowing instead to mount new attacks on pro-Russian rebels. Mr. Poroshenko, in a web statement, said his decision was a response to terrorists, rebels, and looters, and all those, he said, are paralyzing the economy of the region. On Monday, the Ukrainian leader spoke with the leaders of Russia, Germany, and France to continue trying to end the conflict in eastern Ukraine. VOA's Al Pessin reports the effort involves military issues and economic pressure with the hope of some sort of political reconciliation.
The Western and Russian leaders want the relative lull in fighting to continue, but Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko is under public pressure to resume his offensive against Russian-backed separatists. Clashes during the current ceasefire have killed several Ukrainian troops. At the same time, the French and German leaders want Russian President Vladimir Putin to influence the separatists to end the conflict. But Mr. Putin is resisting, claiming he does not control the fighters in eastern Ukraine. And Russian officials say fears of what they call fascists and radicals in Kyiv are justified. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov spoke on Russian television on Saturday. Lavrov said right-wing forces in Kyiv are pushing President Poroshenko toward conflict with the pro-Russian separatists. He accused the United States of doing the same. The Russian position appears to have hardened further after the death Sunday of a third Russian journalist in eastern Ukraine fighting. Meanwhile, the European Union is threatening Russia with what German Chancellor Angela Merkel calls drastic measures in the form of increased economic sanctions if it does not rein in the separatists. But Russian leaders have shown no signs of revising their policy after months of sanctions, mainly related to their annexation of Ukraine's Crimea region in the south. And the head of the Russian and Eurasia program at London's Chatham House, James Nixey, does not expect President Putin to change his attitude now.
He has not made any serious attempt to dissuade any of the more rebellious elements and the more extreme elements who are pro-Russian in the easternmost parts of Ukraine to stand down. And so there is no change in the Russian tactics, that is for sure.
And Nixey says Russia's position is strengthened by reluctance among many European Union countries to impose more sanctions.
It seems unlikely that there will be a renewed bout of sanctions right now. I think that the West is nervous about taking these kind of bold moves without any real understanding of the counterpunches or the effects.
And those efforts would impact Western countries as well, many of whom depend on trade with Russia, particularly oil imports, to keep their fragile economies from slipping back into recession. Still, experts say extending the ceasefire and continuing the talks may be the easy part. More difficult will be finding a political formula that satisfies Russia and the separatists without forcing Ukraine to give up more of its territory. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
France and Germany have reached the World Cup football quarterfinals in Brazil. It was an extra time. Algeria put up a valiant effort but lost to Germany 2-1 on Monday. Earlier in the day, France shut out Nigeria with two late goals, 2-0 the final score, and will be facing Germany on Friday in Rio de Janeiro. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on The Voice of America. As you follow the World Cup, you can find us on Twitter at VOA Football and on the internet at voafootball.com. And we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jesse Brooks, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On July 1st, 1863, Confederate and Union forces began the Battle of Gettysburg. Many historians regard the battle as the decisive engagement of the American Civil War. On this date in 1867, the British North America Act formed the Dominion of Canada, comprised of the Province of Canada, later Ontario and Quebec, as well as Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. In 1881, the world's first international telephone call was made between New Brunswick in Canada and Maine in the United States. In 1898, future President Theodore Roosevelt and his volunteer cavalry, the so-called Rough Riders, secured the San Juan Heights in Cuba, sealing U.S. victory in the Battle of Santiago during the Spanish-American War. In 1916, nearly 60,000 British soldiers were killed or wounded after the first day of the Battle of the Somme in France during the First World War. In 1921, the Communist Party of China was founded. In 1960, the Republic of Ghana was formed. In 1962, Rwanda and Burundi gained independence. In 1963, a more efficient method of delivering U.S. mail was introduced. The zip code, or zone improvement plan, consisted of a series of five digits added to the mailing address. In 1967, the European communities were formally created out of a merger of the Common Market, the European Coal and Steel Community, and the European Atomic Energy Commission. In 1991, the Warsaw Pact, which allowed the Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, was officially dissolved at a meeting in Prague. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Bitter sectarian violence continues in the Central African Republic. More than a year of conflict has killed thousands of people, displaced a million civilians, and led many Muslims to abandon their homes to seek safety in villages closer to the Muslim-dominated Sudan and Chad in the north. Most recently, dozens of people were killed in the town of Bambari in an attack by anti-Balaka militia, followed by reprisals by Muslim youths. Throughout the conflict, the United States has responded to address the resulting humanitarian crisis. With more than half the nation's population in need of aid and nearly 140,000 living as refugees in neighboring countries, the United States is deeply committed to ending the human suffering. Toward this end, nearly $51 million in additional assistance has been provided for Central African Republic relief, bringing total U.S. humanitarian aid to nearly $118 million this year. The newly announced funds will provide clean water, food, emergency health services, and relief supplies. Funding will also help support programs to assist displaced persons and reunite them with their families and surviving caregivers where possible. With rape, assault, and extreme acts of cruelty against innocent men, women, and children being committed every day, increased funding will also support counseling and other services for survivors of gender-based violence. The humanitarian needs in the Central African Republic are enormous, however, and cannot be met by a few donor nations alone. The international community can and must do more to provide assistance to help end the crisis. The Central African Republic's neighbors have welcomed nearly 140,000 refugees since December, and other nations must contribute. Significant resources are needed to save lives and alleviate suffering.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.